This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've got a show full of Oscar nominees.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I say I'm an oil man, you will agree. Now, I've traveled across half our state to be here and to see about this land. I'm a family man. This is my son and my partner, H.W. Plainview. I have many wells flowing at many thousand barrels per day. I can guarantee to start drilling and to put up the cash to back my word.
That's Daniel Day-Lewis as an oil man during the early days of the oil industry in There Will Be Blood. It's nominated for 8 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. Paul Thomas Anderson wrote and directed the film. He also made Boogie Nights, Magnolia, and Punch Drunk Love. There Will Be Blood is loosely based on the 1927 novel Oil by Upton Sinclair, and it's set in California in the early days of the oil industry. I spoke with Anderson in December. You had to learn so much to recreate the period, and you had to learn a lot about the early days of oil exploration. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, like in the early part of the film, when the Daniel Day-Lewis character is first learning how to dig for oil, I mean, the technology is basically like a bucket on a pulley that he pulls up by hand, and then he deposits the oil in a big puddle by the well.
Yeah, that's it.
And then things kind of grow a little from there. Go ahead.
All that stuff just comes from the written descriptions of how Edward Doheny first found oil right near Dodger Stadium near downtown L.A., essentially using what they knew as silver miners, which is you dig a hole. And then they realized they were down about, 50, 60 feet, and that there was they were choking on the fumes. So they say, well, we can't be down here to get this stuff up out of here. How are we going to do it? And they built an A-frame, with a 50-foot eucalyptus tree that they shaved down and were just trying to drive it into the ground. I mean, these really primitive techniques. And the funny thing is, as much as it's changed, it's still kind of the same as it is today. It's just driving an enormous pole into the ground over and over and over again until, you poke the monster enough and it erupts.
There are some really horrifying accidents that happen during the course of the movie while people are digging for oil. Did you study up on what typical accidents were like in those early oil days?
Yeah, we read about a few. And then they're so graphic. I mean, there were a few written about in Upton Sinclair's book and then a few just from various other sources that we had. But then when we built the derrick and we got out there and we had this terrific guy named Jim Farmer, who's an old oil man who came out to help us out with some of the details of the drilling. And boy, once we met him, I mean, the stories just came fast and furious, I mean, to the point where you just had kind of had enough. You're like, I don't need to hear about one more accident, quite honestly, you were aware of the dangers every single second, particularly when you've got a film crew around, just everything was dangerous. The danger that something was going to fall, the danger that your fingers were going to get caught somewhere. I mean, it's horribly dangerous labor, and particularly out there where I think at the time these oil guys worked in 12-hour shifts. So for 12 hours they would work, and then they'd go to wherever the bar was and drink for 10 hours, sleep for 2 hours, probably stop at church on the way in, and then do it all over again. So not only is there the danger just in general, but you factor in booze and heat and all the rest, and it's amazing.
So is one of the accidents in the movie based on a story that you were told about a real accident or something that you read?
The bit falling was a character named Joe Gunda, who we meet very briefly. The bits fall, and he's down in a cellar, which is a place where they sort of collect the mud. That was from the Upton Sinclair book when I first read it. And then talking to some of our old-timers and oil guys, they would just tell us endless stories about bits falling, guys drowning in the mud. And maybe they'd get hit in the head by something that fell, and that wouldn't be what killed them. But, drowning in this mud would be the thing that got them. Not to mention the work that they were doing, high up. These derricks are 80 feet tall. So, from time to time, people would fall. And then, we're not even factoring in what happens when these things do come in. Ideally for them, they knew when they were coming in. They knew they'd sort of hit a certain sand that they were looking at and smelling and saying, okay, we're very close. And they could prepare however they did prepare for the gusher to come in. But those times when a gusher would come in, they didn't know it. I mean, you were in trouble. You were in a lot of trouble, particularly if it lit on fire, and anything could light it on fire. Just a rock shooting up out of the ground could be a spark that could catch a flame.
And that happens in the movie, and there's this huge fire that erupts after the gusher starts gushing. And I'm thinking about how challenging that scene must have been to create. First of all, I don't know if an oil fire burns differently than, say, a wood fire or any other fire, and if you had to make sure that you were creating an oil fire so that the fire would look authentic.
Yeah, well, black smoke is the key. You know, oil burns black, and we were using diesel fuel, and it burned pretty darn close to how real crude oil would burn. We augmented it a little bit with some digital effects, just helping to kind of darken it a little bit. But it sure felt like the real thing. And when we did it, and, you know, we had a special effects guy, a terrific guy named Steve Kremens, and whose job it was to get thousands of gallons of diesel fuel spouting up in the air and then to light it on fire. And he said to us, you know, I cannot guarantee that I can put this fire out. I can do it and I can turn it off. But once that derrick catches on fire, there's a chance I might not be able to put it out. We thought he was just playing it safe, you know, that would be. But the second we lit the match, it was clear there was no way we were going to be able to put it out because the wood was so dry. It was so much gasoline. And we were essentially forced to do that entire sequence within two takes in about 45 minutes before the derrick tumbled to the ground.
Yeah, and the fire is alive. I mean, so you're shooting something that has a life of its own.
Yeah. It doesn't take direction very well.
Right.
But that's what's fun about it, too. You know, it's great. I mean, we were so nervous leading up to lighting that fire because, first of all, we were in love with our derrick. You know, we're so proud of it. And we knew we were going to be completely melancholy when it was gone. Mixed in with that, we were all completely petrified at the prospect of screwing it up. I mean, what are you going to do? We're not going to build it again. That wasn't going to happen, you know. And obviously, we were pretty careful. We weren't going to do it if the wind was blowing too much. But to be really honest with you, it was kind of one of the benefits of shooting out in West Texas because they're a lot looser out there. You know, I don't think we could have done anything like that in California. They would have had a heart attack out there.
Paul Thomas Anderson wrote and directed There Will Be Blood, which is nominated for 8 Oscars. We're featuring Oscar nominees on our show today. Viggo Mortensen is up for Best Actor for his performance in Eastern Promises. It's directed by David Cronenberg, who also directed Mortensen in A History of Violence. I spoke with them both in September. Eastern Promises is a thriller set in London about a nurse midwife who delivers a baby while the mother dies in childbirth. Tracking down the baby's extended family leads the midwife to a man she doesn't realize is a Russian crime boss. In this scene, the crime boss's driver, who also does the family's dirty work, is driving the midwife home. The menacing-looking driver is played by Viggo Mortensen. The nurse is played by Naomi Watts.
Have you ever met a girl called Tatiana?
I meet a lot of girls called Tatiana.
She was pregnant.
Ah, in that case, no, I never heard of her.
She died on my shift.
But I thought you did birth.
Sometimes birth and death go together. She came in with needle punches all over both arms. Probably a prostitute, the age of 14. Do you think Semyon's son knew her?
I am driver. I go left, I go right, I go straight ahead. That's it.
Viggo Mortensen, you not only had to learn a Russian accent for the movie, you have to speak with a really commanding presence and sometimes a very menacing voice, which is totally unlike how you're speaking now. You sound very soft-spoken. completely non-threatening the way you're speaking now. Would you talk a little bit about what you did vocally, both in terms of the accent, but also in terms of the menace that your voice sometimes assumes?
Well, there's one thing that I've noticed or that has been brought to my attention, and it makes sense to me. You know, people have said I speak Spanish because I was raised in a, you know, until I was 11, mostly in a Spanish-speaking country in Argentina. So I speak Spanish like I do English. And also because of my family and living there, I speak Danish. But when I speak Spanish, for example, people have said to me, you sound different, you seem, not just the words, but the tone and your body language is different. And it's something that the language informs you, the sounds you make and the ideas behind them, the sort of concepts that are particular to a culture and a language, change the way you present yourself even without you realizing it. It helps you. It does a lot of the work for you. And the language in this case really helped. There are, you know, I had the advantage from speaking some Latin language that certain R sounds or J, hard J sounds, I could get to them easier. But there are some vowel sounds or combinations of sounds that are particular to Russian and also Ukrainian, which I speak a little bit of in the movie, but although you wouldn't know it. There's a transition into Ukrainian briefly that a Russian would know or a Ukrainian. But those sounds were a little harder to get, you know, the ones that are very specific. But we eventually got there. It was the effort of getting there that also, I just found myself moving differently and seeming different when I was concentrating on getting those sounds right.
It didn't surprise me to finally realize that he spoke fluent Spanish and Danish and pretty good French and some Italian, some German maybe. And also, for both movies, more for this one, but even for History of Violence, accent, language was a key thing. Mm-hmm. In a weird way, Eastern Promises is about language, and to a lesser extent, but still important, History of Violence was too. Now, Viggo's really doing two accents in History of Violence, because the sort of Indiana accent is not his natural accent, and it's very subtle. And then there's the Philly accent that comes later that is, you know, also extremely subtle but really important. So and then once we had worked together, I realized that he wasn't just good, he was great, I have to say. And so then, of course, he was a marked man for me because now I want him to be in every movie that I do. When I was reading Eastern Promises and reading the role of Nikolai, it reminded me that Viggo had always seemed to me to have a Slavic element to his looks, to his face, to his cheekbones. And I don't know whether that's Danish and some great-grandmother was messing around with Russians, or I don't know. You never know. But and I had thought that when we were shooting History, because a director has a relationship with an actor that's really quite bizarre and not much known, which continues beyond the actor's actual physical presence. You know, I'm in the editing room and I'm obsessively looking at my actors' faces, looking for the best take, the most subtle intonations of their voice. And sometimes I'm even taking sounds from one take and putting them in the mouth of another take. So you become incredibly sensitized to an actor's face and physical presence and voice. And so all of that I had gone through with Viggo in History of Violence really made me feel that he was absolutely the perfect guy for Nikolai.
David Cronenberg directed Eastern Promises. Viggo Mortensen is nominated for Best Actor for his performance in the film. Ratatouille is nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Animated Feature Film. In June, I spoke with Brad Bird, the film's writer and director, and Patton Oswalt, the comic and actor who does the voice of the main character, Remy. Remy is a rat who yearns to be a chef. Here's a scene from Ratatouille. Remy is talking to the ghost of the late celebrated chef and restaurant owner Gaston in the rafters of Gaston's old restaurant. They're looking down into the kitchen, where the kitchen porter has accidentally knocked the soup pot from the stove and is desperately trying to recreate the soup, throwing everything in sight into the pot. Gaston speaks first.
Now, who is that?
Oh, him? He's nobody.
Not nobody. He is part of the kitchen.
He's a plongeur or something. He washes dishes or takes out the garbage. He doesn't cook.
But he could.
No.
How do you know? What do I always say? Anyone can cook.
Well, yeah, anyone can. That doesn't mean that anyone should.
Well, that is not stopping him. See?
No! No! No, this is terrible! He's ruining the soup! And nobody's noticing it! It's your restaurant! Do something!
What can I do? I am a figment of your imagination.
But he's ruining the soup! We gotta tell someone that he's not...
Patton, what was your reaction when you got the call saying, you're perfect to play a rat?
I think my reaction was more, I wasn't even concentrating on, oh, I'm going to be a rat, was that I had gotten a call from Pixar, and it was a Pixar movie being directed by Brad Bird, because I'm such a Pixar fan from back in the day. I mean, the short films, Luxo Jr. and Red's Dream, I would see them at animation festivals, and then I watched all the Pixar films.
You're a nerd. So
I'm a huge Pixar nerd. So it's like asking, you know, a guy. It's like asking some weird Star Trek shut-in. Hey, would you like to play Kirk's son? Excuse me, what? All right. You know, you can't even. I couldn't even get my mind around that I was doing this. Luckily, it was a 2-year process of doing the voice, so I've been able to get my footing at this point. You know, if it had been quicker, I would be the worst guy to promote this movie, because I would just be me going, I can't believe I met Brad Bird and we talked and we had sandwiches. Okay, so this is weird. It would be so pathetic. He wouldn't want to talk to me right now.
Brad Bird, did you cast Patton Oswalt, and what made you think that his voice would be perfect for the main rat?
Well, actually, you know, he was talking. I heard of this comedy routine he did, Black Angus, about Black Angus, and it was he was so volatile about food and so passionate and funny about it. You know, it just struck me that's the character. You know, he's so volatile, but in a good way. I mean, Patton has very strong opinions about anything, and he'll let you know. And when he loves something, he loves it. And when he hates something, he hates it. And that kind of extreme emotion is perfect for Remy, you know.
Patton, can you do a little bit of the Black Angus bit that Brad Bird heard you do?
Yes, it is very early in L.A. I'll try to do it with the same energy that he heard it. But basically, it's about how the commercials for the Black Angus restaurant, and Black Angus used to be a very friendly restaurant where I come in and have a steak and have a baked potato. It'll be a good time. And you go, that sounds fine. And then over the past few years, the commercials have turned into this like gauntlet of threatening food where it doesn't even look pleasant anymore. And there's this, it sounds like an initiation rite now. At Black Angus, we'll start you off with an appetizer platter featuring 5 jumbo deep fried gulp shrimp served with a side of our butter and cheese cream soup and 15 of our potato bacon bombs and a big bowl of pork cracklings with our cheese and
what the hell, a couple
sauce.
Of corn dogs.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're like, oh, you know, well, we're each going to split that. No, you'll each get your own. Then we'll take you to our mile-long soup and salad bar with our He-Man 5 head of iceberg lettuce salad served in a canoe with 18 pounds of ranch dressing and, what the heck, 4 cheeseburgers. Like, oh, man, you know what? I'll just get a little mixed green salad. Hey, I'll put on a dress and curtsy before I bring you a mixed green, buddy. Why are you yelling at me? And it just never ends.
Brad Bird, why did that make you think of the refined rat in your movie?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I think it was the passion that I was responding to more than anything else. The fact that he could get so wound up about the food. You know, because, you know, Patton also talked about how he just loves steak, you know, The weird thing is I didn't really grok that Patton was a foodie. That was just one
did
of many routines.
Grok?
On grok.
You just said,
yeah, that's a Steve Jobs word, by the way.
Grok?
It precedes,
hey, that's
like,
a Steve Jobs word.
It precedes
and
Steve
I
Jobs.
I learned it from
that,
Steve Jobs.
Isn't that from, like, Vonnegut or something? Is
I
it?
Think it's
I don't
know. Steve used
no,
it.
Oh, it's Heinlein. Heinlein. Robert Heinlein.
Oh,
yeah.
I just nerded out again.
You
excuse me,
Terry.
No. Yes. It's Heinlein, not Vonnegut. Excuse me. No,
yes.
You're wrong.
Isn't that Lovecraft?
Yeah. No, I actually heard that from Steve Jobs. So, yeah, okay. So Steve uses that word.
Okay, good.
But I didn't know that he was a foodie. We actually hired him, and he was working before I knew that he was. This is like a major thing for Patton. If he goes to any town, he scouts out what is the most happening restaurant in that town, mm-hmm. and he will send you a menu. I mean, he will email you the menu from a great restaurant. And he's emailed me a few, and he'll like say, order this. And you know, I mean, he's a major foodie, and that's perfect. But we didn't know it when we hired him.
Brad Bird wrote and directed Ratatouille. Patton Oswalt does the voice of the main character, Remy. Ratatouille is nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Animated Film. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're featuring Oscar nominees on today's show. The Savages has 2 nominations, Best Actress and Best Original Screenplay. I spoke with Tamara Jenkins, the writer and director of the film. Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman star as Wendy and John Savage, siblings who have just found out their estranged father has dementia. After they move him into a nursing home, Wendy insists on trying to get him into a more upscale place. During the screening process, Wendy makes it seem as if her father is more mentally with it than he really is. Here's the scene right after that, when Wendy and John are outside arguing.
What'd you say to them?
I said he was pretty good, except he goes in and out every once in a while.
In and out? Wendy, the man's got dementia.
I know, but they only had beds for people who were more independent. I thought if we could just get him in there.
Why are you wasting our time on fantasies?
She said she would put him on one of the waiting lists. I mean, Jesus, I'm just doing it for Dad.
Dad's not the one that has a problem with the Valley View.
No, I'm just trying to improve the situation. Is that a crime?
There's nothing wrong with Dad's situation. Dad's situation is fine, but he's never going to adjust to it if we keep yanking him out of there. All right, and actually, this upward mobility fixation of yours, it's counterproductive and, frankly, pretty selfish.
Selfish?
Yeah, because it's not about Dad. It's about you and your guilt. That's what these places prey upon.
I happen to think it's nicer here.
Of course you do. Because you're the consumer they want to target. You're the guilty demographic. The landscaping, the neighborhoods of care, they're not for the residents. They're for the relatives. People like you and me who don't want to admit to what's really going on here.
Which is what, John?
People are dying, Wendy. Right inside that beautiful building right now, it's a f***ing horror show.
Tamara Jenkins, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Love the film.
Oh, thank you.
You know, I was telling a friend about your movie, The Savages, and I said something like, well, it's a movie about 2 adult children who are kind of estranged from each other, who get together to take care of the father they're kind of estranged from, who now has dementia and has to be taken to a nursing home.
And I said, I said,
and it's really funny. And they looked at me, they were so puzzled. And I thought, like, when you sat down and knew you were making a comedy, and it's not like a slapstick comedy, but, I mean, there's parts of it that are just, like, really funny. How do you figure out where the humor is in such a really sad situation?
I mean, I guess a couple things. I think it's a sort of sensibility that is kind of part of my DNA or the way that I see. And I don't really separate. I mean, the world separates comedies from tragedies and, you know, dramas from farces. But I actually think that if you are paying close attention in life, that you'll see that they actually are operating in stereo most of the time. If you kind of look underneath, you know, if you look under the tablecloth or look through the curtains or, you know, if you're sort of attentive, you can kind of hear under tragedy is a kind of human farce happening also.
One of the things the daughter has to do is fly with her father from Sun City, where he'd been living in a retirement community, to Buffalo, New York, where her brother teaches. And, you know, she's taking him to a nursing home in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know from our previous interview that you flew with your father to assisted living or nursing home. I'm not sure which.
Right.
But what was your experience like flying with him on the plane? And how incapacitated was he at that point when you were flying with him? Like, that's such a difficult thing to do. And I think it's something so many people have faced. Making
it's a really difficult trip.
Yeah.
And it's kind of almost this, invisible thing until you've had the experience. I don't think you quite. And now anytime I'm on an airplane and I see I feel like I see it all the time now. Like suddenly my, you know, eyes, I've woken up. And I think that I didn't quite, as, you know, Wendy doesn't quite understand the complexity of the task at hand. Besides the emotional impact of, you know, what she's doing, I don't think she even realizes sort of the physical burden of transporting someone who kind of can't take care of themselves. And I think the sort of gravity of that becomes more and more clear.
When your father had dementia, were there certain things that were like essential, deep parts of his personality that became more pronounced, even if they were different during his dementia period than they were before?
It was a very, with both of my family members who suffered from dementia, it almost felt like, sometimes it felt like an amplification of them in this, you know, like the volume sort of being turned up on aspects of their personality that might have been slightly more buried. It was very heightened, but it didn't feel unfamiliar.
And what was it for your father? Which qualities?
I think it was a kind of volatility that was always there that just seemed louder and more, the swings of it were sort of really strong and striking. And also that sort of interesting thing about someone with dementia where they're sort of retreat and you feel like they're not present, and then they will just wow you with some zinger. Like you didn't even know they were there. You didn't know that they were present, and then some, almost like a punchline comes flying through the night and you can't believe it. So my father was actually really funny, and sometimes out of the blackness of dementia that he'd just say something and slay you.
Well, you cast Philip Bosco to play the father, and he's really terrific in the role. A very kind of crusty, sometimes bitter, and sometimes just like really, really sad. And I guess I'm curious what the audition was like, whether you just kind of said you got the role or whether there was an audition.
There was an audition, and I was very concerned about the casting of the part, and it was very important to me that he wasn't trivialized, that the character wasn't trivialized as a bastard with a twinkle in his eye. I just didn't want that cutification that I think often occurs with difficult old men. Just felt like that would be a disaster, and I wanted it to be very honest. And so I was reading people, and my casting director, Jeannie McCarthy, suggested Phil Bosco, and I was being a really dumb, literal director person, and I was thinking, oh, Phil Bosco, he plays judges and, you know, kind of well-heeled patriarchs, and he does Shaw, and he's too fancy. Anyway, in walks Phil Bosco, and he sat down in our little room, very small room where we were reading people, and he read with my casting director, and it was the scene in the diner where the kids ask him if, dad, you know, what would happen if you were in a coma? He says, what the hell kind of question is that? It's, you know, the place, the Valley View, they need it for their records. You know, what the hell kind of hotel is it? Dad, it's not a hotel. It's a nursing home. So he was reading the scene, and when Jeannie, who was playing opposite him, kind of, you know, reads the line, Dad, it's, you know, not a hotel, it's a nursing home. I think inside that pause, the way he was sort of absorbing that information was quite beautiful and stunning. And he wasn't, you know, he wasn't begging for sympathy. He was just blunt and tough and just playing it so truthfully and so straight. I really was kind of nuts for him, and I very unprofessionally leapt up and hugged him after his audition, and he kind of straightened himself up and started heading towards the door. And I think that he became very suspicious of what kind of movie is this. Directors don't usually leap up and hug people after readings. And he turned around on his way out, and he, just to make sure that it wasn't some fly-by-night operation, he said, so Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman, they're attached to be in this, right? I think he thought, and I said, no, really, really, I swear, this is very professional. But I think he was suspicious, rightly so.
Well, I love that scene because, you know, as you say, he doesn't like play it for pathos or sympathy or anything. By the end of the scene, he's yelling at the two kids that they're idiots, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a great scene. Why don't I play it?
Dad, we need to talk about a couple things.
But we don't want you to take it in the wrong way.
Okay. Yeah, it's just it's a couple questions that'll make everything easier in the long run.
Okay. Okay. In the event that something should happen, How do you want us to,
Dad, what if you're in a coma?
John.
Would you want a breathing machine to keep you alive?
What kind of question is that?
Well, it's a question we should know, in case.
In case what?
In case something happens.
Nothing's gonna happen. Right now, nothing new.
Right, it's this procedure. It's something they want for their records.
Who?
The people who run the place, the Valley View.
What the hell kind of hotel is it?
Dad, it's not a hotel. It's a nursing home.
Unplug me.
What?
Pull the plug!
And that's Philip Seymour Hoffman, Laura Linney, and Philip Bosco in a scene from the new film The Savages, and Savage is the last name of the family. And my guest, Tamara Jenkins, is the writer and director of the film. She also made Slums of Beverly Hills. The children in your story, they're both writers. She's writing a semi-autobiographical play, or as she describes it, a subversive semi-autobiographical play. He's writing a book about Brecht, and their father just isn't like a book kind of guy. And you realize that there's probably a lot of things that they would never be able to really share. And I guess I'm interested in hearing why you wanted to create that kind of relationship on screen where the children's lives are so different from the parents. There's so much, even if he wasn't suffering from dementia, they wouldn't get about each other.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that has to do with what we were talking about before in terms of the estrangement being, you know, extra doubled up. And I mean, I feel like it's something I've seen, you know, in many relationships between parents and children, a kind of almost like foreignness, like, who are you? What have I wrought? And in my own experience, you know, I have three brothers who are professors, and I think that actually in my family, they're none of my parents were educated, and no one went to college, let alone having, you know, gone out and gotten PhDs and teaching at universities. So it was certainly something that I was familiar with, that sort of estranged, you know, just feeling like, you know, that you were from different planets to a certain extent. But I know that I'm not alone in that. I mean, I think that even, you know, parents and children that have more in common can often feel that their offspring or their parent, that nobody knows where the other person came from.
Tamara Jenkins wrote and directed The Savages, which is nominated for Best Original Screenplay and Best Actress. Our final Oscar nominees today are from the film Juno. Diablo Cody is nominated for her screenplay, Jason Reitman for directing the film. He also directed Thank You for Smoking. Cody's entree into writing was through her blog, in which she chronicled her experiences as a stripper. Juno stars Ellen Page as Juno, a 16-year-old who has sex one time and gets pregnant. She decides to have the baby and find a worthy couple to adopt it. Let's hear the scene in which Juno breaks the news about her condition to her father, played by J.K. Simmons, and her stepmother, played by Allison Janney.
I'm pregnant.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but I'm going to give it up for adoption, and I already found the perfect couple. They're going to pay for the medical expenses and everything, and 30 or odd weeks, we can just pretend that this never happened.
You're pregnant?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And if it is any consolation, I have heartburn that is radiating in my kneecaps. And I haven't taken a dump since Wednesday morning.
I didn't even know you were sexually active.
Who is the kid?
The baby? I don't really know much about it other than, I mean, it has fingernails, allegedly.
Nails, really?
Yeah.
No, I don't, I mean, who is the father, Juno?
It's Polly Bleeker.
Polly Bleeker?
What?
I didn't think he had it in him.
Jason Reitman, Diablo Cody, welcome to Fresh Air. Why did you want to write a story where the teenager becomes pregnant at age 16, decides to have the baby but give it up for adoption?
It all came down to sort of this central image that I had in my mind of this teenage girl who was, you know, a little kind of rough around the edges and a little eccentric, sitting across from a couple who were very affluent and kind of polished. And they're essentially having to audition to adopt her baby. And to me, that was a really kind of powerful and strange image. And to me, the power dynamic at work there was really intriguing. And I could see an entire film just kind of in that exchange. And so I decided to build a whole story around that.
Jason, what interested you in the screenplay? What did you relate to in it?
I just found it completely original in every way. I thought these were characters I'd never seen before. They were fully fleshed out. The script had sophisticated moves. It's interesting. I didn't actually remember the story until after we finished shooting, but I have to imagine on a subconscious level this had to do with my interest in the project. When I was 12 years old, my parents decided to adopt a baby girl, my little sister. And they sat me down one day and said, Jason, tomorrow we're going to have a social worker who's going to come visit our home and evaluate whether or not we're a good enough family to adopt a child. And I remember that day, that audition day, when this woman was in our house and was asking us questions, and we were all on our best behavior. My sister and I, who normally fight, were treating each other really well that day. And I don't know, I just remember that feeling, and oddly, I feel as though Diablo and I kind of came to this project from either perspective, Diablo having grown up in a Juno McGuff type house and me having grown up in a Mark and Vanessa Loring type house.
You grew up in the wealthy family house that was auditioning.
Yes, well, when you see the film, there is this moment in which Juno is running up the staircase of the house of the wealthy family, and there's this series of photos of Mark and Vanessa, played by Jennifer Garner and Jason Bateman, and they're dressed in all white jeans with a tucked-in white turtleneck in these goofy poses, and that was taken directly from my childhood, unfortunately.
Oh, really? Your parents were wearing that series of photos?
Every year we did a series of photos. One year it was the all-white. One year it was jeans, white T-shirt, and Ray-Bans. And the third year, and this is probably the worst of them, was underwater.
That's so cool.
No, it really is not.
There's been several articles recently about the fact that in some films, people who don't really necessarily want to have the baby end up keeping it and rejecting the idea of abortion. And two examples would be Knocked Up and your film Juno. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about Diablo making the decision, you know, that she's not going to have an abortion, and also what you think people may or may not be reading into that?
I think, unfortunately for me, you know, it was a strange coincidence that there was so much sort of unplanned pregnancy material circulating this year. It's in the zeitgeist for some reason. You know, we had, like, Knocked Up, A Waitress, our film, and all of them follow a pregnancy. But that's in the service of the narrative. In Juno, she's not pregnant for political reasons. You know, we didn't intend to make a movie about teen pregnancy and the options available to people who find themselves in that situation. Not at all. You know, we just wanted to tell a personal story about maturity and relationships, and the pregnancy is just kind of motivates the story, I guess.
Jason, you know, your father, Ivan Reitman, is a director, and he directed, among other things, Ghostbusters, Meatballs, Are there things that you feel you learned as a director from watching your father?
The most important advice my father gave me, he called me up and he said, you know, Jason, don't worry about making a scene funny or more dramatic. It's almost impossible. And your barometer for comedy and drama will never be as your barometer for truth. When you're watching the scene, ask yourself, does this feel honest? Because that's really your job there, to make sure it feels real. You have to trust your screenplay. You jumped onto the screenplay because you thought it was funny, you thought it moved you. And at this point, it's just a question of, are the actors being real? Listen to what they say, how they're saying it, what they're doing while they're saying it. And if anything feels inauthentic, you should jump on that.
That sounds like really good advice.
It's amazing advice. The kind of advice you wish you'd get in film school, the kind of advice that you'd think would be passed around often. But my father's the only person I've ever heard give that, and now I try to spread that as much as possible.
Jason Reitman is nominated for an Oscar for directing Juno. Diablo Cody is nominated for writing it. Our film critic David Edelstein has a review of the new comedy Be Kind, Rewind, starring Jack Black and Mos Def. It was made by the 44-year-old French-born director Michel Gondry. He first became known for directing innovative music videos for Bjork and award-winning commercials. His first hit feature, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, was directed from a script by Charlie Kaufman. Since then, Gondry has directed his own scripts, the semi-autobiographical The Science of Sleep, and now Be Kind, Rewind.
Michel Gondry's Be Kind, Rewind is pokey and amateurish, but that's not as damning as it sounds. It's a movie about unslick people. It's a monument to unslickness. Mos Def plays Mike, a clerk in a dilapidated New Jersey video store that still rents tapes because the owner, Mr. Fletcher, played by Danny Glover, is behind the times and proud of it. The setup is so loony, it's an eye roller. Mike's paranoid pal, Jerry, played by Jack Black, gets electrocuted breaking into a power plant, picks up a magnetic charge, and inadvertently erases all the store's videos. Egad! Because the building is on the verge of being turned into condos, and because Fletcher, who's away, keeps tabs on the boys via a neighbor, a child woman played by Mia Farrow, Jerry and Mike have to keep the business going, which means shooting their own zero-budget versions of effects-heavy blockbusters like Ghostbusters, Rush Hour 2, and RoboCop. It's Let's Put On a Show, retold as Let's Remake a Movie. Be Kind, Rewind takes a long time to get going, but once Mike and Jerry tote their one measly video camera into a public library to reenact Ghostbusters, it's hard not to bliss out.
And action.
Start over. Sorry, cut.
What?
I looked right in the lens. We gotta start over.
You can't start over.
I looked right in the lens.
You just have to do one good take, all right? Don't listen. What you're doing is good. Just
do the same thing. I am doing good, right?
Yeah, just do the same
thing. Am I doing great?
You're doing great, but don't look at
it. You're doing good, too.
All right, thanks.
With the cinematography.
Okay, good. Go check the cart. Check the cart. Okay, you're doing it. That's good. That's great. That's great. That's good. Put your head down. Put your head down.
I can't see.
Okay, go back to the shelf. Suspecting nothing. It's ghost. Ghost. When you're walking down the street and you see a little ghost,
what
you gonna do about Ghostbusters?
What is that?
That's the Ghostbusters theme song.
No.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Those reenactments account for maybe 10 minutes of Be Kind, Rewind. Gondry might think he's parodying dumb comedies in which poor people rally to save beloved institutions from foreclosure, but too often his film just resembles them. To make the movie's outlandish premise work, the characters have to act like borderline idiots. Mos Def, who's a gifted actor, is on simpleton autopilot, and Jack Black would be a better clown if he were as physically inventive as he is energetic. Because this is a fairy tale, the customers who rent the crude tapes don't come back with baseball bats, but with fervent requests for more remakes, or Swedes in the film's distinctive patois, because at first they're presented as the special Swedish versions. The movie runs down, and yet It has an oddball integrity that's very likable. A French auteur steeped in deconstructionism, Gondry begins by exploring the gulf between the new democratization of movie making, because everyone has digital video cameras, and the daunting amount of money, technical resources, and personnel it takes to make anything that the mainstream audience will want to see. But that gulf can be bridged, he suggests, with wit and humanity. In The Science of Sleep and many of his music videos, Gondry's designs are right on the border between computer-generated and handmade, a kind of childish surrealism that can leave you elated. The funniest things in Be Kind Rewind are not the moments in which Mike and Jerry look like Ed Wood's worst nightmare, but when they find rather breathtaking ways to do for pennies what would cost a Hollywood hack millions and be less expressive to boot. Fats Waller holds this ramshackle picture together. He's the nonconformist who's the source of Mr. Fletcher's dreams and civic pride and the subject of the movie's final act. When Hollywood swoops down and accuses Mike and Jerry of copyright infringement, they make something original, a Fats Waller biopic cast with many of their loyal customers. In Be Kind Rewind, pop culture fosters a sense of community, a communion among these stumblebums, their customers, and us, the audience. In his simple but never simple-minded way, Gondry is a true transcendentalist.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.